Well, you've probably heard Starship had its 10th test flight, and things went pretty well this time around. And so I figured it was time to get the guys back together. So once again, I have summoned Marcus House and Scott Manley to discuss what happened with Flight 10. We talk about sort of what led up to the launch, the interesting things that you should be watching during the flight, and then a lot of the repercussions, and of course, the great elephant in the room, what's going to happen with the Artemis mission. Well, I'm not going to give any more introduction. Let's get on with the conversation. Here is Scott Manley and Marcus House. Scott, Marcus, it's been so long.
It has.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, good. And Scott, you look well-rested and retired.
Retired? That's not true. I'm fun employed. Definitely still employed.
Yeah.
Working very hard to try to make this content creation thing work. Do you guys have any tips?
No. Just got to stick at it, mate. You've been doing this a lot longer than I have, actually. So,
When we first met, I was shocked. Like, we sat down and we were talking and you were like, yeah, and I've got this job. I'm like, wait a minute, what? Because you have such a successful YouTube channel. You do all this work. I couldn't believe that your day job was to be a programmer at Apple. It's bonkers.
I had a family to take care of, and now they're off to college. I am still paying for them, but, you know, I can see the end in sight.
Yeah. No, so that's the part. I'm like, it's just to have fun. Like, you will not work less. But it is you get to have more fun because you get to decide what it is that you're working on. And then the time just disappears.
Get to own my failures.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we need to focus on the task at hand, which is that we are going to talk about the most recent Flight 10. I was, you know, I didn't reach out to summon the group together just because there was exploding starships. Not a lot was accomplished. I wasn't that excited about it. But
you were depressed. Another failure.
Another exploding starship.
Why can't they get through this second stage orbit insertion thingy?
Yeah, starships explode. It's what they do.
Yes.
So apparently
they're meant
to
fly. They're also meant to explode.
So, Marcus, what was the plan this time around?
Yeah, well, as we've just said, the last three Starship flights have been pretty demoralizing because, you know, they haven't been able to progress past where Flight 6 had sort of gotten. So it's been a hard year. And, we just needed to see what was going to happen with this Block 2 upgrade design that they sort of, they made many changes to the internals and all this sort of thing. And presumably this has caused a lot of grief. We don't know everything that's sort of been improved over this time, but this flight, luckily, much better.
And Scott, I think people should understand about, this isn't the ship that was supposed to have flown.
Yes, there was some unscheduled changes due to an unscheduled rapid disassembly on the launch, on the test pad over at Massey's. That was during, they were supposed to be performing a static fire on their static fire test stand. And a COPV, or a composite overwrapped pressure vessel, basically exploded and took out the entire booster, the entire rocket, the entire starship, and the test stand, which led them to an interesting turn of events where they had to retool the orbital launch mount so they could actually perform the engine test for this starship using the launch mount without having to build an entirely new test stand. And they didn't want to do that.
We're going to have a longer conversation at the end of this chat where we talk about the implications of making your launch mount, your test stand, and your landing pad. And what does that mean? And what are the risks involved when you have to move quickly and potentially break things? So we'll get into that. But let's talk about the launch itself. So Marcus, liftoff. On the third day, I guess, we had a bad hose on the first day. On Sunday, we had weather on Monday, but on Tuesday, no delays. The thing took off. How'd it look?
Yeah, look, the launch was beautiful. It really was another spectacular one. And all 33 engines were motoring along beautifully right up past max Q. And then we had just one engine out. And it's interesting because that engine seems to be one that that flames out in previous flights as well. I think it was Flight 8 and Flight 4. I think the exact same engine location. So there must be something around that spot that needs improvement there somewhere. But other than that, the ascent was really beautiful. Hot staging, really beautiful yet again. They did cut away from the Max-Q shot which is kind of like, oh man, that's always a cool thing to see the shockwave come down, and they kind of cut away. Just it's like, come on, that's the one shot I wanted to see. But yeah,
maybe no, Tim caught it or something. Yeah.
John Price caught it, and it was a sublime image. One of those beautiful engines images of a rocket launch yet.
Yeah.
And we cut away from
just
it.
Just beautiful.
Right, right. And then Scott, I want to talk about sort of the plan for Super Heavy, because we've been spoiled watching these Super Heavies come back and land, get caught gracefully by Mechazilla, embraced and put gently down. But in this case, this one was headed for the ocean again. What was the plan, and why'd they do that?
Right. So they'd already demonstrated reuse, the capture and the recovery and the reuse, right? They were now at the point where they wanted to see what the dynamic limits were on the booster, because in the previous flight, they attempted to fly the booster back to the ocean with a very, very aggressive angle of attack, 17 degrees. That's relative to the airflow. And that means they can come down at a much steeper angle. The steeper your angle of attack, the more drag you get, the more cross range you can get. And so therefore, that helps you in terms of your safety zones. You can have the booster coming down further from your tower if it has the ability to glide in, right? But the 17 degrees was too much. It caused too much lateral loads, which caused the downcomer, the big pipe along the center of the tank, to just basically sag and break under the lateral load. So that caused the booster loss in the previous flight. So this time, they found where it broke, they dialed it back, they were still going to be more aggressive than they'd been on previous flights, but they were still going to be pushing the limit. So that was what their big plan was. And they were also bringing it down to a hover, not on the ocean as we've seen in previous hover landings. They actually stopped like a couple of hundred meters up, which is kind of similar to a tower catch. But honestly, I think the thing they were more interested in was making sure it hit the ocean going fast enough that it wouldn't float around for a while.
Right, right.
Yes.
But it was always the plan. The plan was they weren't going to try to catch this one. Like, part of it is that this is the end of the life for this generation.
This is the V2 boosters.
Of the Raptors and the boosters.
Yeah, they didn't want to capture another booster because they would never reuse it, right? So there was no point in this, actually catching this for them. Or, I mean, there would be a point, I'm sure, but there was team catch and there would be team destroy, and team destroy won the day.
Right, right. Let's push this thing to the limit. And that was actually a theme for this entire mission, which was that they push a lot of things to the limit and it seems to turn out all right. But again, that's a spoiler alert. All right, Marcus, back to the story. Starship has detached from the booster and it is on its way. And this is the point where I'm ready to turn off my computer and shut it down because the thing explodes. And it didn't. What's going on?
Right.
What kind of topsy-turvy world are we living in?
Yeah. I mean, the last three flights, you know, the Starship's had all sorts of problems. The last one in Flight 9 did manage to make it to engine cutoff and everything seemed okay for just a little bit. And then, of course, we had attitude issues and issues with, pressure buildup in the nose area and it all went haywire at that point and ended up, you know, ultimately out of control as it was re-entering. They couldn't do any of the payload bay tests. They couldn't do any of the, tests with all the heat shielding. They've got all these experimental heat shields tiles on board, just the heat shield individual ones that they're running experiments with. But they haven't really been able to test any of this stuff since they put them on. There was a couple of test locations in Flight 6, but nothing like what they're trying to test out now, which is regen cooling and all sorts of things like that. So anyway, this one got all the way to engine cutoff beautifully. Everything looked really wonderfully, stable. Everything was in control. At that point, they finally, after all this time, got to open up the payload bay door. So, you know, the company that can launch the largest rocket ever made, you know, almost double the Saturn V's launch thrust and all this sort of thing, couldn't open the door. And that was a meme going around for a long time. For the first time in this flight, we got to see them successfully open that door and deploy these test dummy Starlink satellites, which are just simulator units. You know, they're just presumably got similar masses and things like that, just to make sure that it all works okay before they try to go to orbit and do this for real. So, you know, this mechanism in the payload bay was just astounding.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. I mean, you got a view. You could see these Starlings coming down. You could see the chain that was pushing them out, turning and pushing them out, and then moving the next one down. And that system seems to work as expected.
Yeah, yeah. Fairly complex sort of setup. You know, and I didn't really expect it myself. They sort of push one out and then reverse and then push the next one out. So they've sort of got two in each row. And they sort of do this conveyor belt type thing where they push out one, pull the other one back, and then have another crack at throwing it out. But there was one that sort of just glanced the top of the payload bay door and sort of tumbled out sort of almost uncontrolled. And that was kind of interesting to see. So there's a little bit of adjustment to tweak there.
Yeah, and then it continued on its ballistic trajectory, and then we saw that familiar air glow as things were starting to heat up. And then something happened, Scott. We saw some material floating around, some kind of explosion in the engines. We have
some stuff before that. Well, first of all, I'm going to point out that while the Star Dumlink deployment was somewhat successful, it was still a failure and a tragedy because nobody put cameras on those.
That's true. What
a missed opportunity, right?
The Chinese would have put selfie sticks. Right. When you think about all the Chinese missions, they send out cameras on little floaty spacecraft to show you what the thing looks like. This is the perfect chance to show images. You're so right. How did they not do this?
And it's not like it was a, you know, bizarre idea because everybody's been asking for it.
Yes.
I know. Yeah.
It was nighttime. But anyway, no, before that, they had one other really critical test that they had to do. They had to fire up the engines and demonstrate that they could fire the engine on orbit. Because all these flights have been suborbital. They've all been targeted so they will land in the middle of the ocean, regardless of whether the second stage fires an engine or not after the engine shutdown. And they need to demonstrate that they can reliably relight that engine in space to perform a controlled deorbit. The last thing SpaceX, well, I'm not saying, I think the worst thing that SpaceX could do would be to launch a Starship into orbit and then have it stuck there because the engines have failed and it's now spiraling downwards and we've got 200 tons of stainless steel that could land anywhere. So they had to demonstrate engine firing, and they need to know we've had two tests of this that have been somewhat successful. And so that's what we want, is we want them to show that they can deorbit. And so we had this beautiful little test engine fire. It was very photogenic, and it was great that we could see this with the fantastic skirt camera. I love the way the center engines, you could see them gimbal apart before lighting up that engine. Of course, it felt so right that they would. It was a very cool shot to see that happening. But yeah, they fired those engines up. And so now they're one step closer to going to orbit on a future flight. They maybe do it on the next flight. I don't know. It depends on how confident they are. Again, the stakes are high. Yeah,
And we're gonna talk about that elephant in the room that still remains in the room when we get to the end of this conversation.
The elephant in the room, rather than the elephant falling from space, right?
Yes,
and not burning up on the way down.
Yes,
but yes, reentry was the next step.
Yes, reentry, and I think, you know, you did great analysis of what happened in that engine compartment. What sort of, tell me the events that happened.
So, I mean, yeah, we had this early glow that starts because the heating actually starts well above like 100 kilometers. It's just there's a very tenuous atmosphere. So the air smashing into it does produce light, even although they're like in what would be considered vacuum for our fleshy, you know, human bodies. But then as they start to come down, it starts to heat up. And there was a moment where inside the engine compartment, there's some glow outside. And it's just this massive white light, and then a bunch of debris suddenly fills the compartment. And you can see that it's still effectively zero gravity because
it's all floating around.
Right, it's just floating around like in zero G, but it is technically experiencing re-entry forces. You could see actually pieces floating out and then starting to generate these trails.
Yeah, and then kind of zipping away behind the spacecraft as they
But initially they would fall down and they would make that trail for a good amount of time as they slowly moved out of shot. But yeah, there was a blast, and it looks now that this was coincident with the root of the fin or the tail flapper on, I guess you could call it, right? And our the general feeling in the community that this blast was something related to the oxygen vent system, because we've seen previously there are two vent pipes that come down through that region and exhaust out the back. We've seen this in previous flights. I don't know if they're still there, but that seems to be the opinion that I'm getting. So something overpressured in there exploded and damaged that region. And it probably did the same on the other side, because during re-entry, the two places where we see extensive damage on the flaps are in those regions on both sides. So that probably was the reason they began damaging the flaps on the descent.
There was definitely both sides that was affected somewhat. I mean, one side had definitely had the much bigger pop. And yeah, like you say, there's lines that run down. About the only thing we can sort of think of is, you know, there's engine chill systems that are down in that region as well. So, you know, it could be anything like that. But we're sort of waiting for SpaceX to confirm.
So it was an event that happened very, very quickly. It wasn't like built up gases that suddenly combusted. You can actually step through the footage and there's one frame where it's like normal and then white on the bottom. And that you can tell is because this is a CMOS sensor that reads out one line at a time. So the bottom half is a different time from the top half. And just by looking at the rise time, you can see that the rise time was less than a millisecond, which means this was an event that happened very quickly. It wasn't like a combustion event where it started burning. It wasn't like a deflagration. It was something that happened very, very rapidly. So that's an observation.
Yep. So Marcus, take us through the rest of the descent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, after that event, the big thing that we wanted to know was, you know, are these aft flaps going to hold up? Because obviously there was damage on both of them, obviously more on one side. And, you know, as we sort of got further down into the re-entry where the heat really starts to build up and the G-forces start to pick up, you could really see it starting to glow and melt away some of those areas. There was sort of flappy pieces of stainless steel sheeting, which is 4 millimeters sort of thick stuff. So it's not typical, but, you know, in these pressures, it's just waving around like a piece of, you know, tissue paper. It's almost bizarre to see it. And, you know, so the apprehension is like, oh, man, is this thing going to hold together? However, what we really wanted to know was the forward fins, because the forward fins had been moved in this Block 2 design. They'd been moved more forward and sort of leeward, which is more towards the back of the vehicle, not towards the heat shield side. So what that means is that the plasma can flow sort of around the hinge instead of directly over the top of it like it had been in previous flights where they were just melting through that hinge area. Anyway, that was beautiful. That was the one thing that I really wanted to see from re-entry, seeing that those forward fins perform really nicely. And as far as I can see, there was no damage that we could see from the camera views, because there was cameras on all four fins. We were seeing views from all that. And apart from the two aft areas, which had obviously been affected by this event earlier on, no problem. And, you know, as we got further down into that, down towards max peak heating and stuff, it was clear that the aft flaps were going to hold up quite fine. The big question at that point was, would they still have the control authority? Was there anything else damaged in there that would stop it from performing an on-target landing in the ocean? It really amazing watching those scenes, and probably some of the more, I don't know, some of the scenes from that, especially since there's little pieces of these experimental tiles spitting all sorts of stuff out and probably ablating away, very photogenic, because there's all these sparks and stuff coming from all sorts of places. And I'd love to know each intricate detail, apart from the obvious flap damage, what was going on there. Really cool.
Yeah, I mean, you could see that there was a lot of testing that was going on. There was heat tiles attached to the side of the fin, and so they clearly were testing out different materials. You could see a lot, and when we get to the end, you could see some other stuff that they were clearly testing, and they even said that they were intentionally having no tiles in sections and all kinds of other tests that they were doing. You feel very confident. I was watching the bottom flaps, and I was like, oh, this is a race against time. Those things are getting pretty toasty.
Yeah, it was really just the area that was affected was really all that we saw being sort of melted away. I was actually pretty impressed that it didn't creep further up away from the damaged area. What did you think of that, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, look, the fins are designed with multiple attach points. And we definitely saw a forward fin in a previous flight that barely was hanging by a thread, so to speak. But we knew that they could survive damage from the front and back and still move. We also saw that they were, you know, the control system that actuates these is a dynamic system. It's learning as it's feeling the control authority from one. These fins are being degraded. It's compensating. And in the middle of this, they're actually testing the limits of the control system. They actually, you see that they actually did some very large moves to adjust the attitude of the spacecraft. You know, they pitched the whole thing forwards. They brought it up. They performed cross-range maneuvers. And while they're doing this, of course, they are steering towards their spot in the ocean that they're targeting. But as soon as one of those was gone, they would be dead. The other big question, of course, that everybody had was, we'd seen a very energetic event near the engines. The engines are pretty important for landing. Were they? And we actually saw bits that had hit the engines, had impinged on the engines. They could glide all the way to a perfect touchdown spot, and then the engines might not light. So we were worried that that might happen. And so we were like, we were following this right until the very end.
And what did we see?
A flawless touchdown. It was absolutely, the engines lit up on cue. It transitioned out of the belly flop. We didn't get any camera views from inside the bay. I think the camera might have been destroyed by that point. And then we did get a camera view live from a buoy in the middle of the ocean via Starlink with its 360 camera, sending us the imagery of this booster or this sort of Starship coming down. And it's funny how the first time it came down, I was like, "Wow, amazing! It's coming down!" And then it's like, "Wait, that's the wrong color. What's up? What's up with that? Is that
what is wrong with you? Why are you
orange? Oh,
is that a space shuttle?"
Orange rocket bad is what I keep hearing the Starship people say. Well, now you've got an orange rocket. What are you gonna do?
Yeah,
what are you gonna do? You're now orange rocket.
Now, can we just have a quick Commonwealth check here for the pronunciation of buoy?
I would say boy, by the way. I would say boy, but I'm trying to say American. I would say boy. But
and Marcus, you would say boy as well?
It just confuses people when you say a boy floating in the middle of the ocean.
We would say buoy in Canada.
Okay. But I mean, it does come from the French word for buoyancy, right? Mm-hmm. It's not buoyancy.
Mm. Right? No, I know.
Yeah.
I every now and then I just want to sort of follow
But it does help with understanding what it is.
Heritage. Right? Yeah.
Sometimes the evolved word actually makes more sense.
Right. That was incredible. And in fact, we got another video that was released today.
I think we should talk about how for the last, before that was released, there was a lot of speculation as to what the state of the booster was. And like literally, even I saw Eric Berger tweeting this image and saying the best heat shield is no heat shield, clearly implying that the heat shield had been completely removed, which was kind of... Well, there were other less SpaceX fanboy type people who were implying that the entire heat shield had been ripped off.
Right, which is a weird claim, right? Because, I mean, you're looking at the entry right down to the point where they cut away from the onboard cameras, and all the shielding across the side is clearly still intact. So I don't know.
You can imagine that the center is getting damaged worse than the edges or whatnot, because that's where the missing tiles were. But, I was definitely on... team, this is some sort of orange deposit that is formed. I have some really good theories now in the last 24 hours. I've talked to some real experts on the subject, but
we've done a little reporting on this as well, because it seems to emanate from one tile.
Jack Mayer has a really good photo of that one tile, and it does look kind of orange.
Right. And so you could, like, whether this was intentional or, and that it was combusting, and they were using it as a way to like lock in the heat flow on the heat tiles to get a better sense of what it looked like. It'd be interesting to hear the official SpaceX response. And then the other thing that we saw was the top of it was white.
Right.
Yeah, that's really still confusing to me. I don't know if there's another experimental tile that is trying something different up around the nose, but I mean, at one point the nose would definitely have been getting a a good chunk of the heat with the angle
of attack. They were using a lower angle
of
attack all the way down. So they would have been putting more heat flux on that nose than they had previously. And because it's a two-directional curve, it's actually got a sharper rate of curve on it. Therefore, it should be seeing more heat flux naturally. So it could be that they literally have managed to burn through the vitreous glass layer on top and expose the stuff underneath. That would be unusual, but not impossible.
Yeah, because I mean, I've actually got a couple of sample ones, and really that black coating is just a real thin sort of layer on top of it.
It's
mostly a white tile.
Yeah.
So if that ablated away, that would make sense. If that was, although it does look a little bit like there's a deposit there. Like if you look at some of those new photos just from earlier today, it looks like it's almost a deposit. So it's like, I really want to know what that is.
Yeah, so the new photos came out, and not only are they utterly spectacular and mind-blowing and like jaw-dropping, they also pretty much show that the tiles are still there. You can still see the tile patterns. They are just now orange.
right. And so I think we can just mark that this is an homage to the space shuttle. When you think about it, the original space shuttle tank was white, and then later on they changed it to orange.
It's art!
It's art.
That's what it is. I mean, the Starship landing, the way it belly flops down and transitions to a landing, that is poetry in motion as far as I'm concerned, right?
I think it's a terrifying nightmare that I will never get inside. Oh. No way. Not a chance.
I
know you got a pilot's license. Pilot that, Scott.
Oh, dear. I have been flying some very high-performance jets recently, but I'm not sure I'm ready to fly a Starship just yet.
And like Tim wanted to get on that boat, but, you know.
Yes, I would need a lot more flight experience on that. But yeah, one good theory that has come my way as to the orange coloring is if the tile that it was sourced from, or the whatever, is the transpiration cooled tile. The idea is that the original idea for Starship is that we just transpiration cooling, right? They would blow methane through it and it would perform a protective layer. Well, people that know a lot about atmospheric chemistry and shock heating and things like that have pointed out that if you have a largely nitrogen atmosphere and you're blowing methane into it, it's an analog of the chemical activity on Titan with its orange tholins particulate smog in the upper atmosphere. So we could be seeing something like that. And I'm really interested in that because I was actually at NASA Ames a few weeks ago and they were doing like a Titan reentry experiment. So that's where I'm leaning right now.
Yeah, and I've got a recent interview on the channel talking with somebody about transpiration cooling for hypervelocity vehicles, and we talked quite a bit about whether it would work on Starship and what are the best kinds of gases to use. So it is really interesting to sort of think about that. I doubt that's what they were doing, but it would be amazing if it was. So then, Marcus, I guess lands in the ocean, explodes as they do. I guess finally I got my explosion, I guess.
So, and that's
scheduled disassembly.
That's right. It's sort of a criticism I see. It's like, oh, it just blew up again. It's like, you're not looking at this right. I mean, it's a 50 meter tall, roughly, you know, with 4 millimeter thick steel. It's not made to fall over and stay intact. You know, I mean, they can put all these reinforcements on it so that it has a chance of surviving better. But I mean, you're trying to cut down mass of the vehicle to get payload to orbit. So you don't really want to design in things that aren't needed. And, you know, to say, oh, it exploded. Yeah, of course it exploded. It fell over. It's like, it's one of those things. That's right. So I don't see a problem there. As soon as you break the thing in half, the methane, the oxygen mixes straight together. You've got flames everywhere. Of course it exploded. So, yeah. But the other thing that is worth looking closer into, I think one of the engines looked to be underperforming out of the three. I'm not 100% confident in that from the footage that we saw just earlier today. There was just one with a lower thrust on there than I would have expected, and it seemed to have a bit of a lean. So whether they had some issues due to that little explosion that may have ruptured some chill lines, I'm not sure. But so we'll be looking for information on that.
Now we'll move into the kind of future and speculation phase of this conversation. And the first thing, Scott, is let's talk about the launch platforms, because as we said, the previous ship that was supposed to be on this flight detonated and took the test tower with it. And so they had to do their hot fire test on the launch tower. Where are we? And they're building another one, but where are we in this sort of larger picture?
Well, we have one more V2 ship, if I'm counting correctly, right? So if they're going to fly that one next, they can again do the test on that system. Meanwhile, the V3 test stand has started work earlier than they planned, I expect. So,
but you have this issue, which is like the thing we're all waiting for is to see Starship go orbital and then fire its engines, return, and try to make that Mechazilla capture. But if your test stand is your launch stand, is your capture stand, that's putting a lot of eggs in one basket. So it makes sense to kind of wait and break this process
up. I mean, if you think about it, though, they're only going to have to do one capture with the V2 Starship if they choose to do it on the next flight. So it doesn't matter if it destroys its test stand.
Right. It's not needed anymore.
And then you might argue that, well, if it's V3 Starship, that's a new Starship. So we should probably go back to demonstrating that it can relight its engines in orbit before we launch one to orbit.
Mm. Yep. There's a couple of sides to this argument, really. You've got, so the Massey's test stand was all set up for, and it was just a stand, really. So not as dramatic to try to repair and replace that than anything at the launch site. But the thing with the Massey's site is it was all set up for Block 2, these version 2 starships to be, and boosters to be tested. And there was only the one, there was only the two to be tested at the time. So, given that you've only got these two Block 2s left to fly, one of those that has just gone, the launch tower was set up for the Block 2s. The next launch tower that they're trying to finalize now is set up for the Block 3s. So the old launch tower, the old launch pad, Pad 1's orbital launch mount, that really only needed to survive intact for two more launches. So they kind of took the risk, you know. So let's, instead of having to repair Massey's for a ship that we've only got two more of, let's adapt this. And that way they didn't have to worry too much about any of the fallout from Massey's. And in fact, they could move on to upgrading Massey's to the Block 3 stuff, which they would have had to do anyway. So if anything, Massey's is probably further ahead with the Block 2 upgrades than it would have been. So there's two ways to look at it.
Mm. And then the next issue I want to bring up is the fact that they did launch those 8 dummy Starlinks and demonstrating that they could probably launch with more of them. And if they go into an orbital trajectory, they should be able to actually launch a full cadre of Starlinks. So are we at the point where they could be revenue neutral, where the value they get from launching a bunch of V2 Starlinks pays for the cost of the test, whether or not they get the Starship back?
I mean, so they at this point, they have the biggest heavy lift rocket that is currently operational if they wanted to expand Starship, right? If they wanted to just put a giant fairing on it, they could be launching huge payloads and everything. But yeah, with Starlink, I'm not going to say revenue neutral, but they could certainly actually make revenue. They could actually try launching these, you know, what is it, V2 or the V3 now? Whatever, the big-ass Starlink is the technical
the big
term.
Ones, yeah.
Yeah, the big ones.
The ones that give us broadband in our pocket everywhere in the world or whatever.
Yeah, you'll still need a reasonably big pocket for that antenna. You know, maybe you'll wear it on your head.
My wife was watching she was like, is this just a big Starlink ad? They push it pretty hard.
I mean, Starlink is a major revenue center for SpaceX. They now have 7 million subscribers, they announced. So that is, $7 billion a year? I don't know.
Mm.
Like lots.
It's worth noting, actually, that next year, well, they were saying, there's an article that was saying that by next year, they're hoping to have a higher amount of revenue coming in from Starlink than NASA's entire budget, based on the current budget proposal, right? It's like, crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be putting Starlink in my plane so I can live stream while flying. That would be cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. I'm not sure how legal that would be. But, I mean,
the
like,
captain
this is
may
it.
Tell you to turn off your electronic devices.
Yeah, but I am the captain. I'm the pilot
then you
in command.
Could feel free to ignore the captain. So now I want to address the elephant in the room. And that is Artemis, the long shadow of the Artemis program. Humans on the moon, 2027. That's like 18 months from now it begins, and we don't have a lot of time before we actually are supposed to see humans setting foot on the moon. And I think the thing that, like, that delay, the explosions of the starships, like, what that cost them was time, that they pretty much lost almost a year in going through this process. And yet the time is ticking. So Marcus, where are we, do you think, now? What's left in our to-do list for Starship to be the human landing system for the moon, for the upcoming Artemis?
Yeah, I mean, the thing I like to harp on about a little is legs. There's just one part of the legs. Puzzle. It's like, come on, we need a leg design somewhere to have a Starship actually be able to land on the moon for a start. But the biggest part of the puzzle really is the propellant refilling yes. systems. And you need to have a vehicle up in orbit that's serving as some sort of depot. You need to be refilling that. So apart from getting to orbit and doing a Starlink deploy test, which I'm actually hoping will be the next mission, if they're confident enough in the Raptor relight, all that sort of stuff, then finally we're at a stage where, okay, we're getting payload to orbit, we can deploy stuff, great. At that point, what you could almost do is, if you can send up one empty Starship that's just serving as a depot, you could essentially just top off with each Starlink launch that you'd test out. You could just top off and do some of these propellant refilling tests to see if you can slowly trickle fill this depot in orbit. And, you know, fast forward a year, hopefully you've got so many Starlink missions going up and so many little propellant refilling tests that all of a sudden it starts to really steamroll. And that's the hope, of course. But yeah,
that
there's a long way
like
to go.
Madness. I mean, you're looking at 15 to 20 full Starship launches to just refill the tanker to be able to make its way to the moon. If you're going to then try to turn that into more,
that's right.
All of the intricacies of that process. I mean, like, we just don't know if you can transfer propellants.
We don't know what the payload
is. We don't know if you can have the cryogenic propellants last for long periods of time in the conditions of space. There's just, there's so many unknowns and so much is riding. Like, we need to see the tank in space. We need to see it get refilled. We need to see the human landing system go to the moon. We need to see a test landing.
There's so many steps to tick off, and it seems implausible unless everything goes 100% correctly at this point on, with no issues, and it's just step after step, and they nail everything. It seems hard to really see that happening.
But good news, NASA's getting its budget slashed.
That's right.
You know, there's less of an urgency from NASA's perspective as well.
But don't worry, because we've
he says ironically, just in case you guys are missing that, not pleased.
Don't worry, we have Blue Origin, right? Blue Origin, they are known for developing their projects really, really quickly.
Wait a minute, weren't they supposed to launch a rocket to Mars at some point?
They're launching their rocket to Mars at the end of next month with the Escapade. So, it's currently scheduled for 29th of September.
Yeah, the one supposed to launch in March.
Very much looking forward to their lander. Yeah. I mean, they're trying to do a moon lander mission, and they say by the end of this year.
Yeah.
And I would love to see that. That would be really cool.
Yeah, I would like to see, honestly, like, I would like to see Artemis at least modified in such a manner that whichever company delivers a working lander, they get to carry the first one, right?
Rather it's going to be Firefly. Firefly Aerospace.
Yeah, but you can't put humans on Firefly unless they're
small. They'll pull it off. They're the ones who landed Blue Ghost. Everything worked great. They're the ones I trust. Put a little capsule on top where an astronaut can just hang out inside, fly them to the moon, and return them back from Earth.
Why do you need a capsule? You could have an astronaut just in an EVA suit for the whole flight.
Right.
We've seen this in the 1960s. The lunar escape system, where they could just sit on a rocket powered lawn chair. Yes. Didn't even need IMUs. They figured out how to fly it. They didn't even need controls. They actually figured out you could fly it just by leaning left and right to steer.
Yeah. And they had an inflatable tent that you could just sit on the surface of the moon and wait for rescue. So yeah, NASA has already thought of all of these ideas. I think we've reached the end of our, we're getting silly now. So Scott, Marcus, always a pleasure. Scott, what are some interesting projects that you're working on now that you're retired. You must be working on all kinds of stuff.
I mean, okay, so like obviously I'm working on all my aviation stuff, but that's a whole separate thing you guys aren't interested in. Right now I'm actually, there's a whole series of videos from NASA Ames, which I recorded while I was there in July. And very specifically, I'm looking at this, the Titan atmosphere shock tube simulation, because I think that's kind of relevant to why we might get orange chemicals on the surface of starships. So that is something I'm working on literally as we speak. Well, not literally, but before this and after this.
Yeah. Right now you're kicking back in your backyard, drinking a beer, talking about
A beer.
Yeah. Marcus, what are you working on?
Now that we've had this flight and it's been, you know, successful again, we're really sort of dialing in to see what's going to happen with all the Block 3 upgrades and stuff as they happen. And you know, as to your point earlier, how are they going to catch Starship and the booster and all this sort of stuff? And, you know, we expect a lot of upgrades going on even on the initial tower so that they can essentially use both for that purpose. And, you know, of course, over in Florida, you've got multiple towers that are being, well, there's one tower already there. They're already working on building a new one. So, you know, we've got Sean, our photographer, and stuff down at Starbase, and we're trying to dial in to make sure that we're capturing everything that we need to talk about each week, because we really focus on the Starship nitty-gritty stuff each weekend. So, yeah, that's us ticking along.
Yep. And for people who are interested, I've got an interview that I did about a week ago with a legendary architect with the European Space Agency, Marcus Landgraf, about Skyhooks. And he is working on a practical design for Skyhooks. And we talk about that and space elevators. And, you know, he is one of the most senior people at the European Space Agency, and yet is still super excited about non-rocket forms of getting to space and getting into higher orbit. So it's a really interesting conversation with somebody who knows what they're talking about. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. So awesome. Check out that interview. All right. Well, guys, always a pleasure. If people want this to happen again, Starship has to continue to be successful, I guess.
Yes. Keep flying Starship, right? Don't All stop, right. SpaceX. I'm telling you now, don't stop.
Don't stop. Like, in case you, this is your incentive to do this right, to get it done.
Yeah, and big props to them all, because, you know, it was absolutely astounding watching all these steps that have been made. So, you know, congrats, SpaceX. Let's keep it moving.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Big props to everyone except whoever installed the COPV on Starship. That's 136. Yeah, that's
right. Oh, no. Oh, you just called them out. All right. Thanks, guys. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Safe. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Marcus and Scott. And as always, if you aren't subscribed to their channels, they are terrific. And so you should go right now and subscribe to both of their channels. I'll put links down in the show notes so you can do that. Like, of course you have already, but in case you haven't, you definitely should. I'll give you some final thoughts. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew M. Gross, Barely Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielek, Cy Nielsen, David Gilton N., David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Switz, Michael Purcell, Monzo, Nick Borges, Nick Solari, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler Munley, Vlad Chiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. So this is going to be one of those Rorschach tests where people watch this video and then they get out of it what they have their already preconceived notions about. And so people are going to say that we're Starship boosters, that we're SpaceX fanboys. And then other people are going to say that we're not giving them enough props and that we're too skeptical. You know, this is what people always say. And so for me, as a person who tries to be as objective as possible, I get complaints from both sides of the spectrum. And in fact, Marcus and Scott do too. So I think that tells us, that gives us our way to sort of guide. Like, if we're not making everybody angry to some degree, then we're not doing our job right. And so I think this was a launch that we really have to give props to the engineers at SpaceX who pulled this off, that they were able to work through a lot of the issues that we saw with the exploding starships, and they made this work. But there's a long road ahead. We have, you know, as I mentioned in the video, there's a lot of things that need to be done before this becomes the spacecraft that's going to take humans to the surface of the moon. And way longer before this becomes the spacecraft that takes humans to the surface of Mars and brings them home safely to create what I think is probably not a great idea, building a city on Mars. I don't think there's any point to that. So it was amazing to see the progress. I'm looking forward to the growth of reusable rocketry. I am skeptical about both the long-term implications of this, as well as even just the underlying justifications for why this spacecraft exists. And yet, it is hard to deny it's so cool to watch these rockets progress. Here's to everyone at SpaceX, and I really hope that the next mission goes successfully as well. I look forward to your comments down below. We'll see you next time.